Hello, welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name is John, and with me as always is Steve. How are you doing?
I am doing pretty well, John. Pretty good. How are you?
Good, good. Did you see that interesting article about PPP fraud in the news today?
Oh my, what a shocker. Yes, what an interesting article. So it basically came out that employees at both JP Morgan and Wells Fargo were misrepresenting themselves to get access to PPP loans, which is just the worst in humanity.
Yeah, what's up with that? So I guess they were saying that they had businesses and they thought they wouldn't get caught.
Yeah, apparently. They were basically just saying that they were small businesses. And I think that because they were internal workers, they were able to sort of understand how to play the system and how to get access to this stuff. The good news is that over 120 at each bank were fired. So they found the bad actors here.
Can you imagine if you had done that and you haven't been caught yet? You just know they're coming for you.
You know,
but
they're coming for you.
Why are you doing this anyway?
You're doing it because you want to get that free money.
Free money. And this is an easy way to steal. But yeah, I mean, there is a lot of concerns about the PPP fraud, and people would misrepresent because the program moved so quickly. And now finally, the law enforcement, the compliance departments, I mean, you work at a place with a massive compliance department and you think, oh, they're never going to check me.
You do, but it's probably a combination of, you know, poor oversight on the part of JP Morgan and Wells Fargo. And also just, as you mentioned, the SBA, right? Just trying to shovel money out the door, just trying to get as much money as they can out the door, but that really a lot of scrutiny. And that's a cocktail for abuse and fraud and waste. So here's what we got.
Yeah. And that was a concern. If you move quickly, you can't check everything as carefully. And this is just at these two banks. There's already a few hundred. So imagine how many there are of these in the general pool of these loans.
I'm sure we'll hear stories, you know, a year or two from now about how much this program was abused. Definitely.
Yeah. Good thing we have the perfect guest for this kind of story today. We have Yana Afanaseva, the founder and CEO of Competitive Compliance. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for inviting me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, glad you're joining us. And you're joining us from Austria, but the company is actually based in Switzerland. Can you tell us a little bit about Competitive Compliance and what you guys do?
Yes, absolutely. So the company was founded about 4 years ago. So we have just, you know, reached our fourth year anniversary. And what we do is we help fintech startups with licensing, regulations, regulatory approvals, partnerships, and everything around, you know, being able to launch your business or new partnership or new business model in a new country or with a new partner. So that's what we do. And a little bit about myself and my background before starting a company. Actually, I was on the other side of the table. I was head of the regional compliance for PayPal, where part of my job was to travel and inspect and vet different fintech startups all over the world to make sure that they are compliant and meet the PayPal requirements for integrations and partnerships. And before that, I also was actually the number one compliance person in Europe for Amazon.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say you were on the other side of the table. You were the one money laundering or hiding identities or something. And now you decided to, like in a cheesy TV show. But now do you see a greater appreciation for compliance now that companies are having to deal with, are expanding into multiple countries? You see Revolut's going through the process in the US and stories like this PPP fraud that we just talked about, and people are appreciating it more? Or do you feel like it's still kind of something that people see as their obligation to just check the box and move on?
Well, if you are in fintech, if you are a fintech founder, you very quickly realize, right, that in order to launch your business, you need somebody's permission, you need somebody's approval, you need audits, you need license, you need partnerships, you need somebody to say, okay, yes, you could do it. So in that sense, I do see a lot of appreciation for compliance, because if you find a partner or a compliance, you know, stakeholder who could help you do that, you make more money, you launch your product faster, everybody's happy. So in that sense, there is appreciation. But obviously, when it's more business as usual, you know, daily checks, you know, daily monitoring, more routine stuff, I do feel a lot of reluctance and resistance in some cases, because I feel that sometimes people don't know how to quantify compliance input. Okay, nobody went to prison, or we just caught, you know, 150, you know, rogue employees, or whatever the case is. But because it's very difficult to put a price tag for this kind of activities, sometimes people try to think about it, or, well, how do we minimize it? How do we do as little as possible? That happens as well.
That is really interesting. So you're based in Switzerland, which I know has tremendous activity in sort of the cryptocurrency and the digital space. Is that your core focus here, sort of helping startups deal with the compliance issues around crypto?
This is how I started. And because crypto companies, especially in Europe and in Asia, they have grown a lot and they have been proactively seeking licenses and regulatory recognitions. That's how, you know, I got started. But what is kind of interesting is that, as every consultant knows, I quickly run out of time that I have at my disposal. And also there is a limit how much you could decrease the prices. So, and what I also saw is a lot of like younger startups, they still are fundraising, they're still forming the teams, but they need some help. They cannot maybe, you know, engage, you know, a large company to go full speed into a regulatory project, a licensing project, but they need some help to open a bank account, to represent themselves, even to raise money. So in order to kind of diversify, and also it's unbelievable, but I did it 1 year before COVID. I started my digital membership where essentially I used all the documents that I produced for my first customers. I tried to standardize them and I tried to create a digital product out of this. And now younger startups, or even employees of startups who have no other help and have limited resources, they can go download the templates, watch the videos, look at the case studies and kind of learn from that and keep moving forward.
That's amazing. So it's basically compliance off the shelf. They can just access the templates and the regulations. What are the complexities with dealing with compliance regulations in the EU when you have, you know, Switzerland with its own laws, and then the EU as well, and as you mentioned as well, Asia? Like, what sort of complexity does that bring to the business?
Well, to be honest, the biggest complexity and point of friction, and the biggest point that causes delays, is how do you define your business model? Because oftentimes people think, oh, I want to do XYZ, therefore I think I need this license. Or they say, okay, so I want to do XYZ, therefore my technical setup needs to be like that. And people don't really know what it means when, let's say, I want to launch a marketplace, or I want to do payment in installments, or I want to do P2P lending. They have an idea, but they don't know how to define it. And that's kind of a very common problem across all the geographies. I see this all the time. But actually, when it comes to implementing regulatory requirements and specifically like following certain regulations, be it money laundering, be it privacy, be it how do you document your outsourcing arrangements, how do you monitor transactions, doesn't matter, right? There is a lot of alignment across geographies because I feel that first people get inspired by, you know, other countries implementing certain regulations or clarifying things. And also because most of the fintech companies, like the Revolut you mentioned, they want to go global. So they educate a lot of regulators. This is how we do business in Europe. This is how we do business in the UK. This is how we do business in Asia. And they try to lobby or at least advocate for their practices to be transferable, because they don't want to build their products from scratch.
Yeah. It's not understanding the difficulty of operating in multiple markets, right? So we've seen a number of compliance failures, at least in the US. I don't know how closely you follow the US market, but a lot of the fintechs and a lot of the digital currency or crypto-based startups really, again, kind of fumbling the ball with compliance. What do you think causes that? Why do you think this is not the most, or one of the most important things that a founder is thinking of, especially if they get in the financial services space? It's, do we need a culture shift so that this becomes front and center? Or will this always be sort of a secondary concern after revenue and costs and all that sort of stuff?
Well, obviously it's complex. Like, let me maybe explain and give you an example. The most painful and the most complex and the most visible process where compliance has the first touch point with the customer is onboarding. And it's very common knowledge that whenever you have a fintech company, you have a lot of people who register with you and then they never transact or they transact very little. So if you apply, for example, a lot of compliance checks and a lot of due diligence efforts on day one, and then half of your people will never transact, then you're wasting half of your resources. That's kind of, you could say this is a compliance problem, but this is at the same time a business problem and UX problem. So how do you solve that? A lot, and kind of, if you think about how I would suggest to solve it is, you have to understand your risks and you have to understand what is possible, what kind of risks do I take or can I take on day one versus on day five versus on, I don't know, month five, because you learn more about your customers, you have different patterns, you have different technological solutions that can help you. And by being smart about compliance and knowing what's required, but also combining it with feedback that you get from your, let's say, customer support team and feedback that you get from the marketing team, you could optimize the onboarding flow, which is going to be more compliant, but also it can be more efficient and, you know, faster and lose less customers and make you more money at the end of the day. It's never about compliance in fintech.
Yeah, it's always about the product and am I getting...
Yeah, the balance. Yeah, so what I kind of wanted to suggest is the following kind of couple of trends. We have seen that now with the help of technology, when it comes to onboarding individual customers for fintech startups, you could do it within a couple of minutes, right? Because we have facial recognitions, we have documents check, we have sanction scanning. So you could actually onboard and review and approve customer automatically without ever a human potentially needing to do anything. And it's going to be perfectly compliant in most of the countries. But where it comes to legal entities, the onboarding process is extremely painful because obviously you have different layers of data points that need to be checked and geographies and ownership structures and industry risk and all the other parameters. But think about it. When it comes to onboarding legal entities, statistically based on my customers' experience and everything that I hear from my students, it takes about 3 to 6 months to onboard a legal entity. And about 80% of the applicants who start the process never finish the process. Imagine how much waste is there and how much lost revenues and frustrations and lost business opportunities. So it is a compliance problem because you need information, you need understanding, you need to do certain checks. But if you think about the amount of customers who are able to successfully complete the process, it's unbelievable how much potential is there.
That's pretty fascinating. So you work across multiple geographies, right? You mentioned East Asia, Europe, and Switzerland. I'm wondering, is there a geography that has sort of your ideal state for compliance for fintech startups, or maybe where the regulation is more conducive to business forming and business creation?
Well, what I always suggest to my clients when they ask me, like, where do I take my startup? Or, for example, you would say, let's say a company from Asia and they want to have a branch or an entity in Europe to serve European customers. It's one of the most common questions, like, where do I take my startup? And I always say the best thing you could do is to go to a country that has already licensed and supported similar business models. Because if you're trying to do something new in a country that has never seen your business model before, you're going to spend a lot of time educating everybody. Like, you would need to educate lawyers, partners, banks, accountants, tax people, and everybody in between. And yes, if you really want to be in this country, if you have people who want to live in this country, if you want to serve, you know, customers there, or if you have one of your critical partners there, of course you have to go through the process and do whatever it takes. But if you have options, if you can move people, if you are flexible, it's much, much better to say, let's say UK has wonderful experience with P2P platforms, and maybe Luxembourg has wonderful experience with marketplaces and e-commerce because of Amazon and Airbnb and other things. So go where people are familiar with your business model. You will save a lot of time. Maybe it's not a compliance answer, but it's a practical one.
It seems quite practical. Yeah, it seems like it's more the ecosystem than the actual regulatory framework, right?
Yeah, because you never do anything alone in fintech.
Yeah, you're never alone in fintech. Yeah, you know, that reminds me when I've worked for different companies of having to explain things to the first year auditors that come by, and you know, you're constantly explaining your business to auditors and regulators that are coming in. So that really hits close to home, and that makes a lot of sense. Whereas if you're going somewhere and they've done your business before, they're, oh, another Bitcoin cold storage lending operation, just no problem. We know what you're all about. It's a very different experience, I can imagine.
Yes, totally. And it's like every single fintech startup has its own particularities. For example, operating in a card business with all these authorizations and Visa network and how do you do prepayments, it has its own kind of particularities in terms of customer flow and where the funds are and how do you segregate funds and what the expectation is and how quickly you settle. And for example, in crypto, if you, let's say, are using BitGo as your, you know, custodial solution, unless your regulators and auditors and partners know what BitGo is, you have to be prepared to spend a couple of weeks educating them about BitGo. So that's kind of the reality of that.
Yeah, the cold, hard reality. You know, that also puts me in mind of the problem with Wirecard. I mean, that's one of the bigger compliance and straight up fraud kind of things that happened lately. What's your take on what happened there?
Well, I sort of have to be careful there because I do know some of the, you know, inside information because I had a couple of clients who used to work and now continue to work with Wirecard. And to be honest, I have to say that my impression is the majority of the, I would say, people in middle management or in operational roles, they probably had no idea. Like, but as with many large companies, you would see some level of, you know, dysfunctioning, where, you know, one department would say you one thing and then it turns out the other department has a completely different opinion and you have to complete different forms and sometimes you don't have access to the data. So all that happened. But I kind of feel that Wirecard is, and apart from, you know, personal potentially like wrong incentives and clearly fraudulent, like I don't know all the details, but it sounds like there was some kind of fraudulent behavior by the senior management. But if you think a little bit abstract about the situation, what Wirecard did and how they started serving and supporting businesses that nobody else wanted, such as gaming and gambling and some of the other risky industries. Then they figured out how to make this business secure and profitable. like they made a lot of money there, and it's a question how they, you know, allocated this money and how, you know, all the corporate governance worked. But let's kind of set it aside. But what they did, in my opinion, well, a few years back, and how they actually grew, they figured out how to support riskier industries that nobody wanted, so that there is not, you know, people are not complaining, there is a relatively low level of fraud, they understand the risks of these industries, they know how to price it, they know what kind of reserves they need to put in place. And they actually enabled a lot of these types of businesses. And then many, many other companies learned from Wirecard because they saw an opportunity, they saw that this is actually a profitable growing segment. So they figured out, okay, so now we can kind of copy and use this and also serve this industry. So a lot more people went there. And then Wirecard did what they always do. They tried something new. They tried, for example, trying to serve crypto industry. Not everybody was, you know, ready 2 years, 3 years ago, 4 years ago to partner with crypto companies. And they were learning. They were trying to define the risk appetite. So in some, I would say, sense, they were trying to do the right thing in a way that, okay, I want to do a new business. I need to understand what my risks are. I need to understand what is normal for this type of the industry. What's the average transaction size? How customers behave? What are the signs of fraud? What are the signs of normal? And how do we price it? What kind of reserves do we need to put in place? So they were, in my opinion and in my observations, they were willing to do the right compliance activities and risk activities when it comes to, you know, embracing a new business and learning about like new area. So that was actually not a bad partnership in that sense. Like my experience was working with operational people. So obviously it's a completely different angle.
Yeah, it's always amazing how basically a few a few bad apples can ruin a whole company because they're engaging in unethical or non-compliant behavior. So this is, I think, a pretty good example of that. Since you're working in the compliance space and sort of at the bleeding edge of fintech, are there any technologies or business models that you're seeing coming out of your region that are really interesting or that you're really keen to see how they develop?
Yes. So what I'm currently very, very passionate about is how we should use technology and especially artificial intelligence to decrease the number of manual reviews. Because if you work in compliance, you know that technology can get you only so far because customers provide inconsistent information, there are technical failures, there are missing data, something is not, you know, coherent. And then, you know, the typical decision is, okay, when technology fails, we need a manual review. And manual reviews, in my opinion, they're like time bombs. Because first, it's not scalable. You need to educate a lot of people how to do it. And even when people start doing their manual reviews and manual decisions, they take completely potentially different decisions on the same case because they come with a different bias, or they make different assumptions, or they pay attention to different risk factors. And I do believe that reducing the number of manual reviews and automating manual reviews is one of the core, I would say, operational compliance problems that we see right now. And it can happen with resolving false positives that come, for example, from sanction scanning, but it also can come from blockchain tracing, where you have a risk score and you don't actually know what's happening unless you go and look at the, you know, different hops and different linkages. And even sometimes you have to go back to the customer and ask, what did you do? So all these instances, they create a lot of inefficiencies, and they are potentially a problem for scaling any fintech startup, because as you scale, you have a lot more cases that need manual review. And if you hire more people, you have a lot more operational problems. So what I feel needs to happen, and it's not happening yet, but I kind of have seen some of the, you know, proof of concept projects around that, is what if you have enough of manual reviews and you log them and you let the, you know, machine learning exercise, you know, artificial intelligence learn from your recorded manual review cases, and then you kind of apply this forward looking. And you can get actually quite amazing results and very accurate predictions from these models if you have enough data. Of course, if you have, you know, a private bank and you have a couple of, you know, transactions a week, it's difficult to have enough data to learn from that. But if you are Revolut or TransferWise or a company of that scale, it should be possible. So this is where I feel there is a lot of progress to be made.
Yes, from what I've seen, there's been a lot of investments now in sort of using either machine learning or OCR or sort of contextual information algorithms that can help you understand what a document is and what it means. And I think that this will definitely increase the scale and throughput of the compliance industry.
Yes, so definitely this is one of the areas where a lot of automation is possible. And maybe another idea that I just thought of is, how do you do, you know, your risk assessments? Because typically what happened, even during my days at PayPal, somebody would say, okay, we have to do risk assessment. And then compliance people will come up with a very, very long, like a laundry list of 300 lines, 400 lines, 500 lines, because people feel, okay, I'm doing the risk assessment, so I have to be diligent. I have to make sure that I get everything in the paper and I will make everyone aware so that we really know all the risks. And probably half of this risk would be rated as like extremely high or very, very high or like super high, whatever your, you know, scale is. But the problem then is it's not actionable, because when you bring this risk assessment with your 400 lines and 200 of them are super risky to your management team, and they have only this many people and this much resources and this much time, they would ask you, okay, where do I start? How do I solve all these 200? Am I going to prison if I don't? So it's very difficult to operate when your risk assessment is so manual and kind of judgmental. Because imagine if somebody would ask a human to say, okay, pick three out of these 200, where do I focus? A lot of humans would feel very uncomfortable doing that, because they would feel that they don't know enough, they're afraid that they overlooked something, and then they might be punished for that, and there might be some, you know, consequences of this, you know, judgment. So they would potentially try to hide away, or they will insist that all the 200s are equally important and there is no way around. But I feel if we can find a way to automate it and make it more objective and less personal, we potentially could provide better guidance for business people where to focus first or what the cost benefits are.
Well, if I'm asking myself, am I going to go to prison for this? I'm definitely going to give you a call first, Jana. But you know, that's it makes me think of some of the things that aren't very clear cut yet for compliance. So you can automate where there's clear rules, but are there some areas that are kind of where the regulators aren't being very clear, or it's very different from place to place, that make it more difficult to automate?
Regulators are always hesitant and try not to pick winners and losers until they have the data. So I could give you maybe one example of what I've seen, the evolution of the regulatory kind of view that I have seen. And it relates to strong authentication of customer, also called two-factor authentication. When it just came about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, every single e-commerce company complained. They said, we are losing customers, people hate it, second factor authentication is useless, we have better ways of managing fraud. But regulators, they often see themselves as, you know, guardians of consumer interests or, you know, average investor interests. So they're very reluctant to give concessions that may potentially put, you know, people in danger. But if you bring them enough data and say that, hey, by using these tools and by using this logic and by using these methods, even without the second factor authentication, we could capture these volumes of fraud. And our fraud levels, if we don't do any second factor, would be at that level. So if you present the data, most of the regulators would be open to that because they also want to be seen as progressive and, you know, accommodating and working collaboratively with new business technologies. And what happened, I know that maybe 4 years ago, a lot of companies kind of lobbied about, you know, why they should not always apply, you know, strong authentication with the customers all the time, because the argument was, well, if this person is always buying this type of goods from this company using the same credit card, always ships to the same address, why do I need, you know, to interrupt the process? So a couple of years then, regulators came up with the regulatory interpretations, so-called regulatory standards on strong authentication, and they explicitly allowed for a couple of exceptions where you don't need to apply second factor authentication. And I believe that it happens a lot. So first they try to be very strict and kind of demanding, but then if you have enough data to support that not everything is risky, they try to listen and actually issue additional regulations that allow for, you know, concessions or exceptions or special cases and so on.
So what do you wish every fintech knew about compliance that you constantly have to explain, or the issue that they keep running into that you wish they all knew? You have a chance to talk to them right now on the podcast.
Wow, that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of responsibility. But actually, okay, so let's separate it into two kind of buckets. So what I wanted all business people and kind of CEOs and founders to know is that compliance can be simple in a way that it could be applied, or it could be deployed in the same way as you apply or approach technology, meaning agile and lean. So a lot of founders feel that they need to know everything before they can do anything. And that's not true. You can have agile approach to compliance where you build the first step, you launch maybe little operation, you see what happens, then you adjust, then you add, you iterate, and you build compliance over time, which is more cost efficient, but also it is more aligned to your, you know, customer experience and maybe even how you get funded and all of that. So do not expect compliance to be this huge burden on day one. Build it slowly over time and align it to the growth of your company. That's kind of advice that I would like to suggest for business people. And for my peers, for compliance people, I kind of have a different type of advice, because the biggest complaint of many, many compliance people is that they feel a little bit underappreciated and underpaid. They often feel that comparing to maybe people from sales or people from finance or people from business development with the same level of experience, they are not paid as, you know, generously. And also they don't have enough maybe resources for their function, for teams and so on and so forth. But when I ask them, okay, so how do you argue your case when you go to your CEO or CFO and you ask for money, like, what's your argument? And they often say, oh, well, I just tell them they have to pay because it's required by law. And I feel that this is the huge mistake. I'm not saying it's wrong, it's true, but this is the wrong argument, because if you say this is required by law, your CEO and CFO often assume that there is no business benefit. So they think, okay, this is something like taxes or social security or some other annoying cost. So instead of kind of trying to optimize it, I have to minimize it and do as little as possible because there is no value anyway. But if you can articulate the added value of compliance in terms of, if you give me the right tools, I can process customers faster. If you give me, you know, more resources, we could launch more businesses and more geographies faster. So we can actually help you make more money faster and, you know, protect you from financial losses. The argument is kind of going to be completely different and people are going to be much more successful securing resources. Yeah, so that's what I would say.
Yeah, some great information and some solid advice for sure. I'm sure compliance people are paying very close attention to that last part. Thanks for joining us. And how can people get a hold of you, Jana?
Yes, so obviously you could, you know, Google for competitivecompliance.com. But since you're listening to this podcast, it means that you're podcast listeners. So the easiest way to find me would be to find me through my podcast, which is called Compliance That Makes Sense.
Compliance That Makes Sense. Yeah,
for sure.
Well, we'll put that link to that in our show notes. And thank you for joining us on the podcast this week. This is Jana Afanaseva, the founder and CEO of Competitive Compliance. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.